Chapter 9. Jack woke at the changing of the watch to the familiar sound of holy stones and swabs. He was aware that the wind had dropped in the night, but for a moment he could not tell what ship he was in, nor yet what ocean. Then once again the beautiful fact of their escape came flooding into his mind. He smiled in the darkness and said,
"Clear away. We've got clear away."
There was scarcely any light at all below, only just enough for him to make out the shape of Philip Broke moving quietly about the sparsely furnished great cabin where Jack's hammock was slung. And perhaps it was this that threw his sense of place and time out of beat. He had rarely slept in a hammock since he was a master's mate. Broke was already up and dressed. Jack could see the gleam of his gold epaulettes, and presently he tiptoed out to the roar of the great double-handed stones just overhead, and the thump, thump, thump as the afterguard flogged the quarterdeck dry. Jack heard him say good morning to the marine sentry at the cabin door, and then again to the officer of the watch, young Provo Wallace, the Nova Scotian, by the sound of his reply. Smiling still, he sank back into a rosy state between waking and doze. Not only was there a most restful lack of present responsibility, but the tension of yesterday had quite died away. It had persisted well into the night, lasting beyond all reason, but now he could look back upon that series of events as something already in the past. His fury at old Herapath's flight, and Jack had seen him whip the horses, had faded entirely, eclipsed by the contemplation of their luck. Luck all the way. Luck at every turn. He considered old age and its mutilations, and wondered what it would do for him. Examples presented themselves to his mind, not only of mental decay, physical weakness, gout, stone and rheumatism, but of boastful, mendacious garrulity, intense and peevish selfishness, timidity if not cowardice, dirt, concupiscence, avarice. Old Mr. Broke had been tolerably mean. Lord, there was nothing of that in his son. In the course of his career, Jack had burnt or released a certain number of prizes in critical situations, so as to keep his crew up to strength, but 24 in a line was something beyond his experience, and he honoured it extremely. True, Philip was comparatively well-to-do, but even richer men loved another 10,000 or 20,000 guineas. He remembered the nasty wrangle between Nelson, Keith, and St. Vincent over their flag shares in prize money. And even more than Philip's disregard for cash, Jack admired the way he had formed his officers and men so that they followed his opinion and shared his views. Love of prize money was so strong in sea officers and man-of-war's men that it seemed almost contrary to nature. On the other hand, all the Shannons, and not only their captain, had had to swallow the taking of Guerriere, Macedonian, Java, and Peacock, a very bitter string of pills. His mood grew dark at the recollection, and he clenched his fist. Precious little strength there. He felt his arm, bound tight across his chest. Not much pain today, but no power either, scarcely enough to cock a pistol. Broke had formed them very well, and he must have had good material to work upon. He was wrong about his flintlocks, but even so the Shannon's gunnery was excellent. Excellent. There was no other word for it. And Jack was particularly impressed by the small arms men in the tops. The senior marine officer had provided some of his best marksmen with rifled carbines, and they had done remarkable execution, while the swivel guns, firing grape down on a hypothetical deck, had done even better. True murdering pieces, well plied. He had an uneasy feeling that he had never attended to the tops quite as he should have done. Nelson had never much cared for the use of fighting tops in battle, partly because of the danger of fire, and until recently everything that Nelson said was gospel to Jack Aubrey. But on the other hand, he had seen the Java carried into battle in obedience to the great man's dictum, "Never mind manoeuvres, go straight at 'em," and it occurred to him that although Nelson was always right where the French and the Spaniards were concerned, he might have had other views if he had been at war with the Americans. Broke walked in.
"Good morning, Philip," said Jack. "I was just thinking of you and the splendid show of gunnery at quarters."
"I am glad you are pleased," said Broke. "There is no man whose opinion I value more. But the question is, was it up to the Constitution's standard?"
"Why, as to that," said Jack, "I cannot speak exactly for their rate of firing, since I did not have my watch in hand, but I know it was pretty fast. I reckon something short of 2 minutes for their first broadsides, and they did better afterwards. Not as fast as Shannon at any time. Perhaps in the ratio of 3 to 4, or even 5, but pretty fast. and most uncommon true. They hit us very, very hard, you know. Yet accuracy for accuracy, I still think you may have the advantage. Your men were firing with an awkward, uneven pitch and roll, whereas Constitution had a much more regular, see, right on the beam most of the time. Upon the whole, I should say Shannon would have outgunned Constitution, though it would have been a near-run thing with their 24-pounders. As for Chesapeake, I know no more than you. I never saw Lawrence do more than run his guns in and out, dumb show. But he did that briskly enough, and he certainly sank poor Peacock off the Demerara River.
Well, said Broke, I hope to put it to the trial today. We are on our last ton of water. I cannot stay, and I mean to send in to tell him so.
Broke's steward coughed discreetly at the door. What a contrast with Killick's way of bursting straight in, his coarse "wheatles is up," and his jerk of the chin, or thumb, or both. And Broke said,
First breakfast is ready when you are, Jack. I've had mine, and as I know you prefer coffee, I have ordered you a pot. I hope it will be to your liking.
It was not. Philip's steward might be as discreet as a cat, but Jack would have given all his discretion and pretty ways for a pot of Killick's coffee. He'd not had a decent cup since the Java. The Americans had been kind, polite, hospitable, and their sailors thorough seamen, but they had the strangest notion of coffee. A thin, thin brew. A man might drink himself into a dropsy before the stuff raised his spirits even half a degree. Strange people. Their country was coming closer, he observed as he looked through the scuttle. Pouring out another cup of the poor, washy draught, he carried it out onto the quarter-deck. The day was dawning fast, a day full of promise, with a steady breeze in the northwest, and the Shannon was standing in for her morning look at the Chesapeake, perhaps her last look from what Philip had said. All the ritual of washing was over, and the ship presented a beautiful appearance of perfectly scrubbed wood, exactly coiled ropes, yards squared by the lifts and braces, masts and sheets gleaming with fresh slush. It would be an hour at least before the captain of the afterguard called for sweepers. Not a spit-and-polish ship, worn indeed and shabby, particularly in her sails, but clean and eminently serviceable. There was no brass that he could see, apart from the resplendent bell forward, the lambent quarter-deck six-pounder, and the sights all along. The busy deck full of hands were doing something more directly connected with war than making metal shine. Some chipped corroded round-shot, others made foxes, paunches, and seizings, and the forward pumps wheezed round, discharging a thin stream over the side. The hen-coops were already up. The proud cock crowed, clapping his wings in the first rays of the sun, and a hen cried out that she had laid an egg, an egg, an egg! Philip himself was talking to an American shipmaster, one of his prisoners, and over beyond him a score of men, a large party, stood dubiously round the carronades, while some of their number slowly pushed them in and out, under the guidance of two grizzled quarter-gunners with pigtails down to their waists. The Shannons knew that their captain did not like the name of the Lord to be taken in vain, and that he detested coarse expressions. The captain was present, well within earshot, and the course of instruction had a somewhat unearthly air, with its supernatural patience and mild persuasion.
"Good morning, Mr. Watt," said Jack to the first lieutenant. "Is there any sign of Dr. Maturin yet?"
"Good morning, sir," said Watt, leaning his good ear towards him. "I'm entirely to your way of thinking."
"I am glad of that," said Jack,
and in a rather louder voice,
"Have you seen anything of Dr. Maturin this morning?"
"No, sir, but there is Coco waiting for him in the gunroom."
"That will set him up, I am sure. Pray, what are those men by the carronades? They scarcely look like Shannons."
"They are Irish labourers, sir. We took them out of a Halifax privateer that had taken them from an American privateer that had taken them from a Waterford brig. The poor souls hardly knew where they were, but when we told them it was the Shannon and gave them some grog, they seemed pleased, and screeched out in their heathen way. The captain let these fellows enter, though we find it very hard to teach them their duty, seeing that only three of them speak any English. But I hope they will be useful if it comes to boarding. They have terrible battles among themselves. You see those three with broken heads, and they understand the use of pikes and axes. Oh, Dr. Maturin, sir, good morning to you. I trust you found your cocoa hot."
"I did, sir, and return all due thanks," said Stephen, looking wistfully at Jack's cup.
Neither he nor Aubrey could love the morning until they had drunk a pint or so of true, freshly roasted and freshly ground boiling coffee. The cock crowed again, and several of the Irishmen cried,
"Mac na hoigaslan!"
"What do they say?"
asked Jack, turning to Stephen.
"Hail to the Virgin Sun," said Stephen. "We say that in Ireland when we hear the first cock crow of the day, so that if we meet a sudden death before the day is out, we may also meet with grace."
"They must keep that until we rig church," said Watt. "We cannot have Christian practices on weekdays, nor Christian precautions."
"How is Mrs. Villiers?"
asked Jack.
"Somewhat better, I thank you," said Stephen. "Will I look at your cup now? It has the curious pattern on its side."
"Infamous hogwash," murmured Jack, as the first lieutenant moved away to leeward on his captain's approach.
"Listen, Jack," said Stephen in the same low voice. "Diana says that sea captains can marry people. Is it true?"
Jack nodded, but no more, for Broke was at hand, politely asking for news of Mrs. Villiers. Stephen said that the most distressing symptoms were over, that a tonic draught, such as coffee of triple or even quadruple strength, followed by a small bowl of arrowroot gruel, reasonably slab, would set her up by the afternoon.
"And then, sir," he added, "you would oblige me infinitely by marrying us, if you have the leisure."
Captain Broke paused for a moment. Was this a strangely timed pleasantry? Judging from the doctor's demeanour and his pale, determined face, it was not. Should he wish him joy of the occasion? Perhaps, in view of Jack's silence and Matchin's cool, matter-of-fact, unfestive manner, that might be inappropriate. He remembered his own wedding day, and the desperate feeling of being caught on a lee shore in a gale of wind, unable to claw off, tide setting hard against him, anchors coming home. He said,
"I should be very happy, sir, but I have never performed the manoeuvre, that is, the ceremony, and I'm not sure of the forms nor of the extent of my powers. You will allow me to consult the printed instructions and let you know how far I may be of service to you and the lady?"
Stephen bowed and walked off. Broke said,
"Cousin Jack, a word with you."
And in the privacy of the after cabin he went on,
"Is your friend serious? He looked grave enough in all conscience. But surely he is a Romanist, is he not? He must know that even if I can perform this marriage, it is meaningless to those of his persuasion. Why not wait until we are in Halifax, where a priest can do his business for him?"
"Oh, he is perfectly serious," said Jack. "He has wanted to marry her ever since the peace. She is Sophie's first cousin, you know."
"But why the hurry? Don't he know we shall be in port before the week is out?"
"That is the very point, I take it," said Jack.
"I gather there is some question about her nationality. She might possibly be considered an enemy alien, and a marriage on board would settle the matter out of hand."
"I see, I see. You have never married anyone aboard ship, Jack, I suppose?"
"Not I, but I'm fairly sure it can be done. The captain of a king's ship can do close on anything for a man except hang him without a court-martial."
"Well, I shall look into the instructions. But first I should like you to read this letter. It is addressed to Captain Lawrence. I have sent in several messages by word of mouth, saying I should like to meet him ship to ship, but from what you say about him, I imagine they were either not delivered, or that his orders kept him in port. Now it seems to me that the people ashore must know you are gone off by this, with Shannon as your obvious refuge. And since they were so eager to keep you, they might be equally eager to get you back again, and therefore more willing to send Chesapeake to sea. In any case, a written challenge has so very much more weight than anything verbal at second hand. So, with these two considerations in mind, I mean to send my letter in by an American prisoner, a respectable man called Slocum, who lives in these parts. His boat is alongside, and he has undertaken to deliver it. But you know Lawrence. You know what kind of letter is likely to have an effect? Please read it and tell me what you think. I have tried to put it in a plain, straightforward manner, no rhetoric, no flourishes, the kind of challenge I should like myself. But I do not know if I have succeeded, and I hope you will tell me, without the least disguise."
Jack took the letter. "His Britannic Majesty's ship Shannon, off Boston, June 1813.
Sir, as the Chesapeake appears now ready for sea, I request you will do me the favour to meet the Shannon with her ship to ship, to try the fortune of our respective flags. To an officer of your character, it requires some apology for proceeding to further particulars. Be assured, sir, that it is not from any doubt I can entertain of your wishing to close with my proposals, but merely to provide an answer to any objection which might be made, and very reasonably upon the chance of our receiving unfair support. After the diligent attention we had paid to Commodore Rogers, the pains I took to detach all force but the Shannon and Tenedos to such a distance that they could not possibly join in any action fought in sight of the Capes, and various verbal messages which had been sent into Boston to that effect, we were much disappointed to find the Commodore had eluded us by sailing the first chance,
after the prevailing easterly winds had obliged us to keep an offing from the coast. He perhaps wished for some stronger assurance of a fair meeting. I am, therefore, induced to address you more particularly, and to assure you that what I write I pledge my honour to perform to the utmost of my power. The Shannon mounts 24 guns upon her broadside, and one light boat gun, 18-pounders on her main deck, and 32-pound carronades on her quarter-deck and forecastle, and is manned with a complement of 300 men and boys, a large proportion of the latter, besides 30 seamen, boys, and passengers, who were taken out of recaptured vessels lately. I am thus minute, because a report has prevailed in some of the Boston papers that we had 150 men additional sent us from La Hogue, which really never was the case. La Hogue is now at Halifax for provisions, and I will send all other ships beyond the power of interfering with us, and meet you wherever it is most agreeable to you within the limits of the undermentioned rendezvous, viz. From 6 to 10 leagues east of Cape Cod Lighthouse, from 8 to 10 leagues east of Cape Ann Light on Cash's Ledge in latitude 43 north, or at any bearing and distance you please to fix off the South Breakers of Nantucket or the Shoal in St. George's Bank. If you will favour me with any plan of signals or telegraph, I will warn you, if sailing under this promise, should any of my friends be too nigh, or anywhere in sight, until I can detach them out of my way. Or I would sail with you under a flag of truce to any place you think safest from our cruisers, hauling it down when fair to begin hostilities. You must, sir, be aware that my proposals are highly advantageous to you, as you cannot proceed to sea singly in the Chesapeake without imminent risk of being crushed by the superior force of the numerous British squadrons which are now abroad, where all your efforts, in case of a rencontre, would, however gallant, be perfectly hopeless. I entreat you, sir, not to imagine that I am urged by mere personal vanity to the wish of meeting the Chesapeake, or that I depend only upon your personal ambition for your acceding to this invitation. We both have nobler motives. You will feel it as a compliment if I say that the result of our meeting may be the most grateful service I can render to my country, and I doubt not that you, equally confident of success, will feel convinced that it is only by repeated triumphs in even combat that your little navy can now hope to console your country for the loss of that trade it cannot protect. Favour me with a speedy reply. We are short of provisions and water, and cannot stay long here. I have the honour to be, sir, your obedient humble servant, P.B.V. Broke, captain of H.B.M.'s ship, Shannon. Jack skipped the postscript, apart from the last words, "Choose your terms, but let us meet," and handed back the letter.
"No," he said, "I think that is perfectly in order for a man like Lawrence. For my part, I should have left out the fling about even combats and little navy. He knows all that as well as you or I, but I think it will certainly bring him out, unless he is under absolute orders to stay in port."
"Very well," said Broke, "then I shall send it."
He stepped to the door, but then, recollecting himself, he called,
"Pass the word for my clerk."
A small aged man in dusty black clothes and an ill-fitting tie wig came in, and said in a harsh, shrill old voice,
"Is it to be rewrote?"
"No, Mr. Dunn," said Broke. "Captain Aubrey is so good as to approve it as it stands."
"I am glad of that," said the clerk, with no evident sign of pleasure. "I have wrote it 3 times already, correcting the expressions, and there is a mort of work at a stand. Complete book, quarterly account, and slop book, all to be finished and wrote fair before we reach Halifax. Well, sir, what now?"
He had no teeth, and as he fixed his testy, red-rimmed eyes on his captain, so he munched his gums, bringing his nose and chin close together in a way that had daunted post-captains before Broke was born.
"Well, Mr. Dunn," said Broke in a tone that lacked its usual authority, "I should like you to look through the printed instructions, or any other papers that may occur to one of your great experience, for information on marriage at sea in the absence of a chaplain, the powers of the captain, and the due forms to be observed."
The clerk sniffed, took out his spectacles, wiped them, and peered at Jack, then, seeming to change his mind about some tart reply, walked out, muttering,
"Marriage! Marriage! God preserve us all!"
"I inherited him from Butler when they gave me Druid," said Broke, "and have suffered under him ever since. It is much the same with my boatswain. He served under Rodney, and we were shipmates in Majestic when I was a squeaker. He taught me how to make a midshipman's hitch, and he used to cuff me when I got it wrong. He was quite bald even then. They lead me a sad dance of it between them, and if it were not that they know their duties through and through—however, we must get this letter off.
The captain, Broke, who emerged onto the quarterdeck with a letter in his hand, did not look as though any man on earth could tyrannize over him, nor as though any subordinate could lead him a dance, however old. Slim, self-contained, and as it were, invulnerable. He glanced eagerly at the land, automatically at the sky and the set of his sails, and turned to the American.
"Here is the letter, Captain Slocum, if you will be so good," he said. "All is ready, I believe, Mr. Watt?"
Yes, sir. The gentleman's boat is alongside, with his men and his dunnage already in it."
Leaning over the rail, he added in a powerful voice,
"Mind the paintwork there!"
"Good morning to you, then, Captain," said Slocum in a harsh nasal drawl, putting the letter away and preparing to leave. "I reckon we may meet again, maybe a little later today, and I dare say my owners will be overjoyed to see you."
His face, with its sardonic expression and unwinking hostile gaze, vanished below the rail. The boat shoved off, hoisted its sail, and sped away close-hauled on the brisk northwesterly breeze over the bright blue sea. They watched it grow smaller in the distance, the sail shining in the brilliant day. Fine on the larboard bow lay Cape Cod, on the starboard quarter Cape Anne, and on the beam, right down at the bottom of the enormous bay, Boston and Chesapeake. The master, or rather the acting master, a young man named Etoff, was the officer of the watch. To him the captain gave orders that brought the Shannon round in the track of the boat, following it in slowly under topsails alone. Then he said,
"Mr. Watt, would you care to breakfast with me?"
And looking about among the young gentlemen on the quarterdeck, he chose a lean midshipman and added,
"Mr. Littlejohn, do you choose to join us?"
"Oh, yes, sir, if you please,"
said Mr. Littlejohn, who had smelt the captain's bacon this last 5 minutes, and whose soul was ravished away by the thought of the eggs that might accompany it. The midshipman's berth had been on short allowance this many a day. The breakfast was indeed magnificent. The steward, aware of Captain Aubrey's appetite and willing to do his ship honour, had broken out almost all his remaining stores. The third part of a Brunswick ham, kippered herrings, pickled salmon, 17 mutton chops coming hot and hot, besides eggs, a kind of toasted scone, and 2 pots of orange marmalade, small beer, tea and coffee as the doctor had recommended it to be made. There was little conversation, however. Broke was silent and withdrawn, and by long-established naval tradition his first lieutenant could not speak without being spoken to. Yet this did not apply to Jack, and he addressed a few remarks to Mr. Watt, but he was on the wrong side of the lieutenant's good ear, and after 1 or 2 attempts he confined himself to Littlejohn.
"Are you any kin to the Captain Littlejohn of the Berwick?" he asked.
"Yes, sir," said the youth, quickly swallowing. "He was my father."
"Ah," said Jack, wishing he had asked some other question. "We were shipmates once, long ago, in Utterp. A thorough seaman. I do not suppose," he said, considering Little John's age, his lack of emotion, and the year the French took the Berwick, "I do not suppose you remember him very clearly."
"No, sir, not at all."
"Could you eat another chop?"
"Oh, yes, sir, if you please."
Jack thought of his own boy, still in coats. Some day, would George reply to the same question in the same words, with the same decent but unmoved gravity, and continue eating with the same undiminished appetite?
"I'm sorry to cut breakfast short, gentlemen," said Broke, after a just decent interval, "but I hope we shall have a great deal to do today."
He stood up, and they followed him out. A certain odd, nervous tension was evident on the crowded quarterdeck, too, and indeed throughout the frigate men moved quietly, rarely speaking, often glancing far over the bay where Slocum's boat had vanished, or at their captain.
"Mr. Etoff," said Broke, "colours and best pennant, if you please, and lay her for Boston Lighthouse."
The Shannon's ordinary pennant came down on deck for the first time for months, a frayed, wind-worn and now rather stubby object, although it was the mark of a king's ship in commission. The replacement soared up to the main royal truck, and there broke out, one of the Shannon's rare luxuries, a long, long sapphire-coloured silk affair that streamed over her quarter high above, while at the same time a worn blue ensign appeared at her mizzen peak, and an equally shabby union at the jackstaff. The breeze had slackened, backing a little westward, and the frigate, as close to the wind as she would lie, scarcely made good 2 knots against the ebbing tide.
"Masthead there," called Broke. "What do you make of the boat?"
The lookout's voice came down.
"It ain't in yet, sir. No, not by a long chalk."
Almost imperceptibly the shore came closer, more distinct. The arms of the bay thrust very slowly further out to sea, so that Cape Ann crept towards the Shannon's beam, bearing north by west, then past each several shroud to north by west a half north, and due north itself. In the dim light of the curtained master's cabin, Stephen said very softly, "How are you feeling now, Villiers?" No reply. No pause in the even breathing. She had gone to sleep at last, and with the quietness of the ship, the smoothness of the motion in this untroubled water, her whole person had relaxed. Her fists were no longer clenched, her face had lost the fierce, obstinate look of resistance, and although it was still pale, it was no longer deathly. Her gruel had done her good. She had washed in what little water the Shannon could afford her, and above all, she had done her hair. It streamed up, pure black, on the pillow, showing the boyish fluting of her neck, and an ear whose formal perfection surpassed that of any shell he had ever seen. He contemplated her for a while, and then slipped out. As he stood on the main deck, blinking against the brilliance of the day, bemused, deep in his own thoughts, impeding the busy men, the captain of the maintop, a former patient of 3 ships ago, took him gently by the elbow, and saying, "This way, sir, clap on with both hands now," guided him up the ladder to the quarter-deck. Here he joined the purser, the surgeon, and the clerk who welcomed him, told him that they were lying to off the lighthouse, that there on the port bow were the Graves, and then the Roaring Bulls, and that today they had great hopes of— Their words ceased abruptly as Captain Broke desired Mr. Wallace, the second lieutenant, to carry a glass up to the masthead and tell him what he saw. Young Wallace sprang onto the hammock cloths and ran up the ratlins as though up an easy flight of stairs, up and up, and from the jacks his voice floated down into the listening silence.
"On deck there! Sir, Chesapeake is out in the road, at single anchor, I believe. She has had royal yards crossed.
Where is the boat?
Sir?
Where is Slocum's boat?
Still this side of the Green Island, sir," called Wallace after a searching pause,
and the silence fell again, broken by the sounding of 7 bells in the forenoon watch.
"If she is in the outer road, and if she has crossed her royal yards, she is most certainly coming out. She will win her anchor at slack water and sail on the first of the ebb,"
said Mr. Dunn, munching his gums with satisfaction. He had the printed instructions under his arm, and a sheaf of papers folded into the book, but his whole being was directed landwards, to the burial, rather than to the marriage service.
"To what do you refer?" asked Stephen.
"Why, the Chesapeake, of course," they cried, and the purser added, "Constitution won't be ready for sea this month and more."
They fell to a close discussion of the state of the tide, the steadiness of the wind, and the new double-breaching of the carronades. Although Stephen's acquaintance with these theoretically non-combatant gentlemen had been short, he had already observed that they were even more martial than the rest. Dunn the clerk and Aldham the purser had commanded parties of small arms men at quarters, blazing away themselves like fury, each with 2 loaders, and the surgeon had bitterly lamented that his post below the waterline always kept him from any action except the occasional boat expedition. But even so, Stephen was surprised by their steady flow of technicalities, their keen appreciation of the finer points, their heartfelt longing for violence and bloodshed. Their flow was cut off short by another hail from the masthead.
"Sir, they are shipping the capstan bars!"
A pause.
"She drops her for topsail! Main and mizzen! Some trouble with her anchor!"
"A foul anchor won't take Lawrence long," muttered Jack.
"He is coming out," said Broke, turning to his officers with a smile. "Mr. Etoff, we will dispense with a noon observation. Strike 8 bells and let the hands go to dinner at once."
All hands were prepared for this. The aged boatswain already had his call to his lips as the marine hurried past him to strike the bell, a sound almost invariably followed by the enormous hullabaloo of cooks bawling out mess numbers, men running and roaring with mess kids, sailors beating on their plates and banging tables. But on this occasion, strangely muted. It was as strange as the calmness with which the Shannons received their captain's statement to his first lieutenant, made loud and clear that today grog would be cut by half, to be made up some other time.
Having made this announcement, Broke hailed the masthead again for news of the boat. It was still well short of the Chesapeake.
"It is not my challenge that is bringing him out, then," he said to Jack, "but rather a desire for your company."
After a few moments, he said, "I am going aloft. I wish you could come with me, but I do not suppose you can use your arm."
"For the masthead, no," said Jack, "but I can't manage the main top, through the lubber's hole."
They crossed the deck, and Dunn moved forward to intercept them.
"For this marriage, sir," he said, "I am afraid it is within your competence, and it seems that banns are not required at sea. Here are all the references, and I have marked the Book of Common Prayer."
"I really cannot attend to a marriage now, Mr. Dunn," said Broke. "I'm going aloft. But now I come to think of it, the lady must be moved. We are likely to clear for action very soon, and she must be moved. Mr. What? Tell me the state of the forepeak."
"Well, sir, now that the pigs are all gone, it is pretty salubrious, apart from the rats and cockroaches.
Then as soon as the men have finished their dinner, let it be prepared. It may be sprinkled with eau de cologne. There is an unopened bottle in my quarter gallery, and a cot may be slung."
Then, raising his voice,
"Mr. Wallace, come down and wait for us in the top."
"Easy does it, Jack," he said,
as his cousin began to climb like an ungainly three-armed spider. Between them, Broke and Wallace heaved his 16-stone into the sighting-top, and Broke carried on to the masthead, running aloft like a boy. Wallace passed Jack his telescope, arranged for a stunsail for him to sit on, and observed that,
"It must be devilish awkward, with only one arm."
"Oh, as for that," said Jack, "I'm perfectly all right on deck. After all, Nelson boarded the San Nicolas and then the San Joseph with only one eye, and won the Nile with only one arm."
"Will you leave me your glass, Mr. Wallace?"
"Thank you."
The young man vanished. Jack glanced about the top, a spacious, convenient top, with a stouter armour of red-covered hammocks wedged into the netting between the stanchions than he had seen in a frigate, and 2 1-pound swivel guns aside, and then settled to focusing the telescope, a difficult task with the fingers of his right hand only just peeping from the bandage and the sling. The blur grew clearer. A cautious twist, and there was the Chesapeake, sharp and clear among a crowd of small craft. Jack could not see her forecastle, an island was in the way, but at the masthead Broke had a perfect view, and he called down,
"Anchors apeak! They pawl and back!"
At this moment the American frigate fired a gun, dropped her t'gansels, and sheeted them home.
"Anchors away!" called Broke. "He plucked it up in fine style!"
Now the Chesapeake cleared the island, full into Jack's sight, and he could see the hands laying aloft to rig out the stunsail booms. The breeze was as fair as it could be, and as soon as Lawrence was clear of the last turn in the channel, clear of the light, he would set them on either side. Already the yachts and small craft had spread all the sail they possessed, the breeze being lighter in with the shore. On the Shannon's deck the hour of grog had arrived. The fife was squeaking Nancy Dawson, the master's mate, stood by the tub, ladling the half-rations, but this high point of the seaman's day lacked all its wonted fire. The hands tossed off their half-pints, barely savouring the rum, and hurried on to the forecastle and the starboard gangway and into the foremast rigging to stare at the Chesapeake. The whole watch below was high aloft. Broke remained at his masthead for a while, saying nothing, watching with passionate intensity. Jack, having already seen the Chesapeake at much closer quarters, swept the harbour with his glass and the town. He saw the Asclepia and picked out his very window, the broad, straight street running up to the State House, the street with a hotel in it. And he searched among the distant shipping for the Arcturus before returning to the frigate and her attendant crowd of boats. And now here was Broke, running down the topmast shrouds.
"Well, Philip," said he, smiling, "your prayers are answered."
"Yes," said Broke, "but was it right to pray for such a thing?"
He spoke very gravely, yet his face was lit up, almost transfigured.
"Come, let me give you a hand past the futtocks."
On deck again, and Broke said to the officer of the watch,
"Course due east, Mr. Faulkner, and we may keep under an easy sail."
The backed topsail filled, the Shannon turned smoothly, brought the wind right aft, and stood out to sea. She had hardly gathered way before the Chesapeake rounded the lighthouse and set stunsails aloft and alow, and they sheeted home together, while at the same moment her royals flashed out over all. A pretty piece of seamanship. From the Shannon's deck she was hull down, and indeed the lower part of her courses could not be seen except upon the rise.
She was about 10 miles away, and even with royals and stunsails abroad, she would not be able to make much more than 6 or 7 knots with this breeze, even with the ebbing tide. There was plenty of time to draw her right out into the offing, beyond the capes, where there was all the sea room in the world. Plenty of time. And since the Shannon made a clean sweep fore and aft almost every day at quarters, since the cabin furniture was so sparse and so contrived that it could be struck down into the hold in a very few minutes, while the officers' bulkheads and canvas screens vanished even sooner, and since she always had enough ammunition on deck for 3 broadsides, it seemed that there might be little to do to fill those necessary hours. Yet in even the most zealous ship there was a world of difference between clearing for action with a purely ideal enemy and preparing for battle with a large, formidable frigate that could actually be seen, that had the weather gauge, and that showed every sign of a determination to close as soon as possible. Apart from anything else, no officers made their wills or wrote what might be their last letters home before quarters, whereas many, including both Jack and his cousin, now determined to do so as soon as they had the leisure. And then there was all the boatswain's work, puddening and chaining the yards, and the gunners, filling more cartridge, rousing up more shot, grape, round, and canister, to say nothing of the wetting and sanding of the decks, the rigging of splinter netting overhead, the spreading of damp fear-naught screens over the ways to the magazine, the placing of scuttle-butts of water for the men to drink between bouts. While as far as the surgeons were concerned, all instruments were to be thoroughly overhauled, and in many cases sharpened. And before the galley fires were put out, there was also the minor question of the officers' dinner. Jack was already longing for his, but when Broke proposed a last tour of the guns, he walked along with him and the gunner and the first lieutenant without more than a private murmur. As he had expected, not even the keenest eye could find anything amiss, but he was glad when, on reaching the forecastle, Broke asked him whether he had any suggestions to make.
"Since you ask me," he said, "I should like to see slow match as well as flint locks. Your locks can miss fire, scatter the priming. A match whipped across can save the shot, and I believe you cannot afford to waste a single shot with a gentleman over the way."
Nodding towards the distant, but not so very distant, Chesapeake, now under t'gallant stunsails as well.
"Besides, it is the old way, and I like old ways as well as new."
The gunner coughed approvingly, and Mr. Watt, who had caught the remark, said,
"Aye, indeed, the fathers that begot us."
Broke considered, and then said,
"Yes, thank you, cousin. We must certainly not waste a single shot. Mr. Watt, let it be so. But, Lord, I am forgetting. How does the forepeak come along?"
"It is as trim and trim as we could make it, sir. It is not an abode of angels, like the master's cabin, but at least it smells as sweet as new-mown hay."
"I must wait upon the lady," said Captain Broke,
glancing at the Chesapeake and then at the sun.
"Pass the word for Dr. Maturin.
Dr. Maturin, how good of you to come. Is Mrs. Villiers well enough to receive me, do you think? I should like to pay my respects, and explain that she has to be removed into the forepeak, as we may very shortly be in action."
"She is considerably better today, sir," said Stephen, "and would, I am sure, be glad of a short visit."
"Very well. Then pray be so kind as to let her know that in 15 minutes' time I shall do myself the honour of waiting on her."
The guns were finished. The officers were gone to their dinner in the gunroom. Broke tapped on the cabin door.
"Good afternoon, ma'am," he said. "My name is Broke, in command of this ship, and I am come to ask you how you do, and to say that I fear we must ask you to change your quarters. There may be a certain amount of noise presently, indeed an action, but I beg you will not be alarmed. You will be in no danger in the forepeak, and the noise will be much less. I regret it will be dark and somewhat cramped, but I trust you will not have to stay there long."
"Oh," said she, with great conviction, "I am not at all frightened, sir, I assure you. I am only so sorry to be a burden, a useless burden. If you will be so kind as to give me your arm, I shall go along at once and be out of the way."
She had had time to change, to prepare herself, and when she stood up in her travelling habit, she looked more than usually elegant. Broke led her forward through lines of transfixed seamen, all of whom, after one quick, astonished glance, stared straight out through the open gun ports. Forward, then down and down to the forepeak, well under the waterline. It was a small, three-cornered space, airless, reeking of eau de cologne, and the dim light of a hanging lantern showed that a numerous party of rats had already joined the cockroaches on the cot.
"I'm afraid it is worse than I had thought," he said. "I shall send a couple of hands to deal with the rats."
"Please, please," she cried, "do not trouble yourself for me.
I can deal with rats. And Captain Broke, she said, taking his hands, just let me wish you victory. I am sure that you will win. I put my whole trust in the Navy.
You are very, very kind, he said with deep feeling. Now I shall have an even greater motive for doing all I can.
Jack, he said, returning to the cabin where Captain Aubrey was already deep into a sea pie, you never told me Mrs. Villiers was so beautiful.
She is a handsome woman, to be sure, said Jack. Forgive me for starting, Philip. I was so damned sharp-set.
Handsome? She is much more than that. Perhaps the most beautiful woman I have ever seen, although she was so pale. Such grace, and above all, such spirit. Never a question, never a complaint. Walked straight into that foul forepeak, alive with rats, and only wished us victory. She puts her whole trust in the Navy, she said. Upon my life, that is a fine woman. I do not wonder at your friend's impatience. The kind of woman a man would be glad to fight for. I shall be proud to call her cousin.
Aye, said Jack, thinking of Mrs. Broke. Diana has the spirit of a thoroughbred. Moves like one, too.
Broke was silent for a while, prodding at his sea pie and then at the fried remains of yesterday's suet pudding, covered with purple jam.
I am going to shift my clothes directly, he said. None of my uniforms would fit you, I am afraid, but some of the officers are about your size. I will send to the gunroom.
Thank you, Philip, said Jack. And if you could find me a pretty heavy sabre, that would be even more to the point, or anything with real weight and an edge. For the rest, a brace of ordinary boarding pistols will do.
But your arm, Jack! I'd only thought of asking you to look after the quarter-deck guns. Their midshipman is away in that unlucky prize. How I regret it!
I will lend a hand there, or anywhere else, with all the pleasure in the world, said Jack. But if it comes to boarding, or repelling boarders, it stands to reason I must have a go. I shall get Maturin to bind my arm tight in. My left is as good as ever it was. Better, indeed. And I can look after myself pretty well.
Broke nodded. He had a grave, contained look. Most of his being was far away with all the innumerable responsibilities of a commander, responsibilities whose crushing weight Jack knew so well, and whose absence he felt so clearly now. But he dealt with various small, immediate problems before the meal ended. Among other things, he sent the mate of the hold and a hand named Rakes, once a professional rat-catcher, into the forepeak. Then the steward, having brought an armful of clothes from the gunroom, they changed, Broke helping Jack with his awkward arm.
"Before we make a clean sweep," he said, "shall we exchange the usual letters?"
"Yes, certainly," said Jack. "I was about to suggest it."
He sat down at Broke's desk and wrote,
"Shannon, off Boston Light. Sweetheart, I hope and trust we shall be in action with the Chesapeake before the day is out. I could not wish for more, my dear. It has been a sad weight on my heart all this time. But should I be knocked on the head, this is to bring you and the children my dearest, dearest love. And you are to know a man could not die happier. Your affectionate husband, John Aubrey."
He sealed it, handed it across, and Broke gave him his. They walked on to the quarterdeck without speaking. All the officers were there, and all had changed their uniforms, some, like Broke and his midshipmen, in the modern style of round hats and Hessian boots, some, like Jack, in the traditional gold lace, white breeches, and silk stockings. But all wore finer clothes than usual, as a mark of respect for the enemy and for the occasion, and they were all gazing steadily astern where the Chesapeake, coming down with a fair wind and an ebbing tide, was well clear of the now distant land, hull up and throwing a fine bow wave. The senior marine lieutenant, a tall, burly young man, came up to Jack with two swords.
"Would either of these answer, sir?"
he asked.
"This will do admirably," said Jack, choosing the heavier. "I'm very much obliged to you, Mr. Johns."
"On deck there!"
hailed the lookout.
"She's hauling her wind!"
She was indeed. The distant Chesapeake, turning, turning until her stunsails would barely set, showed her long side, fired a gun, and filled again. She was clearly inviting the Shannon to shorten sail and try the issue now, in this present stretch of sea. Many of the yachts and pleasure boats were still with her, or not far behind.
"Very well," said Broke. "Mr. Watt, let us finish clearing the ship. There is little to be done, I believe."
"Stephen," said Diana, as he came into the forepeak with a can of soup, "what is happening? I did not like to trouble Captain Broke, but what is happening? Are they chasing us?" Will they catch us?
As I understand it, said Stephen, crumbling biscuit into the soup, Captain Broke has sailed right into Boston Harbour, directly challenging the Chesapeake, and now both ships are moving out into the open sea for the battle by common consent. It is not really a question of pursuit.
Oh, she said, and absently she took three spoonfuls of the soup.
Lord above, she said, what is this?
Soup, portable soup. Pray take a little more, it will rectify the humours.
I thought it was lukewarm glue, but it goes down quite well, if you don't breathe.
How kind of you to bring it, Stephen. She ate on until a cockroach fell into the can from a beam above, when Stephen took the pot and put it down among the other cockroaches on the deck. They were sitting side by side on the cot, and Diana linked her arm through his. She was not given to demonstrations of affection, and perhaps she had no great store of affection to demonstrate. An unaffectionate creature, upon the whole, though passionate enough in all conscience, and the gesture startled him.
"Perhaps I spoke too soon when I said we had got clean away," she said. "I should have touched wood, clung to it. Tell me, Stephen, what are our chances?"
"I am no sailor, my dear, but the Navy lost the last three of these encounters, and as I understand it, the Chesapeake has a far more numerous crew than our ship. On the other hand, the two are almost exactly matched in guns, which was not the case in the former actions, and Jack expresses great satisfaction with his cousin's attention to gunnery, while, as far as I can judge, Mr. Broke seems a most capable, energetic commander. Perhaps our chances may be nearly even. Not that my opinion is worth a straw.
What will they do to us if we are taken? I mean, you and me and Jack Aubrey?
They will hang us up, my dear.
I'm sure Johnson is in that ship, said Diana, after a silence.
I dare say you are right, said Stephen, his gaze fixed on the beady eye of a rat in the far corner, gleaming in the lantern light. He is a passionate man, and he has a great deal to pursue.
He drew out a pocket pistol and shot the rat as it advanced upon the soup.
I brought these for you, he said, taking the other from his left-hand pocket, and here are the little shot and powder flasks. I advise a quarter charge, no more. Picking off the rats as they appear will occupy your mind, besides diminishing the nuisance.
By God, Maturin, cried Diana, you could not have had a better thought.
She dropped his arm, reloaded the smoking pistol, and rammed home the wad.
Now I need not be afraid, she said, her eyes as fierce and proud as a falcon's.
It was the first time since he reached America that he saw the woman he had loved so desperately, and he walked aft with his mind unsettled, aft to the cockpit where the assistant surgeons and the ship's barber were arranging their instruments. The Shannon's surgeon himself was still on the quarterdeck, so keen was his delight in the prospect of a battle, and he was unlikely to be with them much sooner than the first casualty. Jack came below to have his arm bound in, and Stephen, knowing that argument would be of no use in this case, chose three bandages of unusual length and a kidney dish, and took him aside. As the folds of the cingulum mounted Jack's barrel-like chest, binding the dish firmly over his heart and his arm over that, he asked after Diana.
"She is very well, I thank you," said Stephen. "I took her a little biscuit and some portable soup for my colleague's comforts, and she found it went down gratefully. Her mind is occupied with the rats, I lent her our pocket pistols, and with the forthcoming action. She is much restored. Her physical courage was never affected at any time."
"I'm sure it was not," said Jack. "She always had plenty of bottom. I mean, she was always game."
And then, in a low voice,
"Broke was very much concerned at not being able to marry you today. He hopes to do so tomorrow."
Stephen only replied, "When do you suppose it will start at all?"
"In something like an hour, I think," said Jack.
But when he returned to the quarterdeck, he found that he had been out. The Shannon had hauled to the wind and reefed her topsails. The Chesapeake was coming up fast, with three ensigns abroad, and now her bow wave spread high and wide. Broke called his men aft, and as he addressed them in his rather precise, formal voice, Jack saw that they listened with grave, fierce attention, some showing the emotion that their captain concealed with a fair degree of success. There was evidently a total sympathy between them. The borrowed sword, hanging awkwardly at his right side, took Jack's mind off the brief address, and in any case he was immediately behind the captain. He only caught the words,
"They have said that the English have forgotten the way to fight. You will let them know today there are Englishmen in the Shannon who still know how to fight.
Don't try to dismast her. Fire into her quarters. Main deck into main deck. Quarter deck into quarter deck. Kill the men, and the ship is yours. Don't cheer. Go quickly to your quarters. I'm sure you will do your duty."
Jack did not catch all the words, but he did catch the answering growl of assent from the whole length of the crowded decks and gangways, and it raised his heart like a trumpet blast. A seaman on the starboard gangway, a former guerrier, said,
"Hope, sir, you will give us revenge for the Gerry today."
And in this very particular atmosphere of freedom, an old quartermaster spoke up, with a discontented look at the shabby blue ensign, the best the Shannon could do in the way of colours after so many months at sea, and said,
"Mayn't we have three ensigns, sir, like she has?"
"No," said Broke. "We've always been an unassuming ship." The sand in the half-hour glass ran out. Boston was now 20 miles away. The glass was turned. 8 bells struck, and Broke gave the orders that sent the Shannon slowly eastwards again, her foresail clewed up, her main topsail shivering. And so they ran, a good glass and more, the Chesapeake crowding sail in the Shannon's wake. Silence on the quarterdeck. Silence fore and aft. Only the quiet breeze in the rigging, and little of that with her sailing large, and the live water running along her side. And into this silence the voice of the midshipman at the masthead, reporting what every man could see. The Chesapeake was taking in her stunsails, royals and t'gansels. She was striking her royal yards down on deck. Watt glanced at his captain.
"No," said Broke, "we will keep ours up. I do not trust this breeze. It may die away." "Mr. Clavering," to the midshipman high aloft, "you may come down now. And Mr. Watt, you may heave to and beat to quarters."
The Shannon turned, the way came off her, and as she lay there gently heaving on the swell, the drum volleyed and thundered. In a moment the men were at their stations, clustered in exact order round their familiar guns or in the tops or along the gangways, and the crowded quarterdeck thinned as the officers and midshipmen ran to their divisions, leaving only the master to con the ship behind the helmsman, the aide-de-camp midshipman, the first lieutenant, the marine officers, and the captain to direct all, with Jack a supernumerary behind him. The purser and the clerk, both wearing swords and pistols, were already with their small arms parties. The Chesapeake was coming down fast, hauling her wind as she came and steering for the Shannon's starboard quarter. As well as her three ensigns, she wore a large white flag at the fore with some marking upon it, apparently words. Broke raised his glass and read, "Sailors' rights and free trade." He made no comment, but said to Watt,
"Let us have stopped ensigns at the mainstay and in the shrouds, ready to break out in case our colours are shot away."
Then he hailed the tops in turn, each under the command of a senior midshipman.
"Mr. Leake! Mr. Cosnahan! Mr. Smith! Is all well?"
And each in turn replied, "All's well, sir." Closer, and the Chesapeake was still heading for the Shannon's starboard quarter.
"I hope to God he minds what Nelson said and comes straight on," thought Jack.
"Will he cross my stern, rake me and range up a larboard?" murmured Broke, staring fixedly for the least movement of her rudder. Then, without shifting his gaze, loud and clear,
"Second captains and crews to the larboard guns! Flat on the deck if she rakes us! Don't fire till she bears true!"
A patter of bare feet as the larboard sections of the gun crews ran to the other side, and then silence again, with the smoke from the match tubs drifting across the deck. A quick, low order, and the Shannon's main topsail filled, giving her a little way. Then she shivered it and brailed up her driver, moving just enough to steer. The Chesapeake was not going to cross the Shannon's stern. Her wake was straight and true, and now it was too late for her to turn. Lawrence had waved the advantage in order to bring his ship right into action in Nelson's way.
"Handsomely done," said Jack,
and Broke nodded. Watt said,
"That's what I like to see."
"Starboard guns," called Broke,
and the men ran back. Never a sound among them. Closer, and closer still. The words on the flag were quite clear now, yet at this angle not a broadside gun on either side would bear. Closer, closer than musket shot. And at 50 yards the Chesapeake luffed to run up parallel with the Shannon and fight it out, both ships with the breeze a little before the starboard beam, the Chesapeake to windward.
"Handsomely done,"
said Jack again. Still this silence, and Broke called down through the cabin skylight to his coxswain, the captain of the aftermost starboard main deck gun. "Mind 'em, fire when you bear on the second main deck port from her head. And Shannon's, no cheering till it's over. Do not waste a shot." The Chesapeake was ranging up, squaring her mainyard to check her way. Her shadow, huge and ominous, fell across the Shannon, and in the silence Jack could hear the run of the parting water at her bow. He saw Lawrence Plain, standing there on his quarterdeck, a tall figure in that same white coat. He took off his hat and waved it to him. But at that moment the Chesapeake gave three roaring cheers, a strangely British ring, and at the same time Mindham's gun spoke out. Splinters flew from the Chesapeake's side just abaft the second port, a split second's pause in which Broke said, "Half past 5, Mr. Fenn," to his note-taking youngster, and Mindham's neighbour fired, together with the aftermost carronade of Jack's division, followed by the bow gun, and then a prodigious rolling broadside from the Chesapeake. From that moment on, all was shattering din, the guns firing as fast as they could load, one broadside running into another, dense smoke from both ships sweeping over the Shannon's deck, the whole air and the smoke in it quivering with the huge, incessant concussions, with the orange stabs of flame jetting through the darkness, the bright sun quite veiled, and the crackle of small arms from the two opposed gangways and the tops, the high bark of the swivel guns. The long waiting silence was utterly gone, the long tension, a kind of grave, quiet anxiety with each man very much alone, annihilated, and this was a continual, enormously active present. Jack moved along behind the starboard quarterdeck carronades. There was little he could do as yet, for the crews were fighting their pieces beautifully, talking in quick, jerked-out words, laughing, racing them in and out, sighting every shot with a quick, intent glance through the smoke at the pendulums that told them when the ship was on an even keel, cheering as the ball or grape, or both, went home. The confusion of noise was so tremendous that it was difficult to be sure, but he had the impression that Shannon was firing faster, truer than Chesapeake. The second captain of the aftermost carronade jerked round, staring straight at Jack. The fierce excitement was still blazing in his face, but already his eyes were puzzled, astonished, wide. Jack dragged his body clear. A bar shot had opened all his belly, and his mates ran the gun out, fired and sponged, with no more than a single backward glance. Smashed blocks and stray rigging rained down on the netting overhead, and splinters were flying inboard among the smoke in deadly swathes. The Chesapeake was hauling up a little to check her way, and in a gap through the smoke Jack saw her helmsman killed, her wheel smashed. Her whole quarterdeck was strangely empty, had been from the very first broadside, and he no longer saw Lawrence at all. At this point, both ships had the breeze a little before the beam, but the Chesapeake's motion suddenly increased, and she came right up close to the wind. Her headsails had probably been shot away, as well as her helmsman killed. And there she lay, with no way on her at all, showing the Shannon her stern and larboard quarter. And now the Shannon mauled her terribly, shattering her stern ports, sweeping her decks in a long, murderous diagonal, doing the most shocking execution, and blood ran thick from her lee scuppers.
"She's going to haul away," said Broke. "Mr. Etuff, port your helm."
"She has sternway, sir," cried Watt. "She's paying round off."
This would bring the Chesapeake's uninjured broadside into action, and coming round, gathering headway, she could also board. A fatal move, perhaps, with her much larger crew. Broke nodded, put the Shannon's helm astarboard, and roaring in his speaking trumpet through the bellowing of the guns, ordered the mizzen topsail to be shivered to keep her off the wind. But even as the sail trimmers leapt to the braces from their guns, those few of the Chesapeake's that could be brought to bear shot away the Shannon's jibstay, and with no jib to swing her, she hardly moved, whereas the Chesapeake, her sternway still on her, was coming backwards towards the Shannon, and coming fast. The lane of water between them narrowed, and all the time the Shannon kept up this tremendous fire, flinging hundredweights of iron and lead at the closest range, and still the Chesapeake came backwards. An overheated quarterdeck carronade overset on its recoil, breaking its breechings, and Jack was too busy helping to check it as it plunged among a mess of hammocks blasted from the nettings and of blood to see what was happening forward, until he heard the crash as the Chesapeake's quarter came grinding against the Shannon's side just amidships. But as he looked up, he saw the Chesapeake, her sternway checked, beginning to forge ahead. She had dropped her forecourse. Yet scarcely had she made a few yards, still grinding along the Shannon's side, but her quarter gallery hooked in the fluke of the Shannon's best bower anchor. In an enormous voice for a man of his size, or of any size, Broke roared,
"Cease fire! The great guns! Main deck boarders away! Mr. Stevens, lash her fast! Jack, Mr. Watt, quarterdeck men forward to board!"
Then, throwing down his speaking trumpet, he cried,
"Follow me who can!"
He raced along the starboard gangway, drawing his sword as he ran, and leaping over the bodies of his clerk, the purser, and several of their men. The moment the carronade was tripped, Jack followed him with the quarterdeck boarders through a violent, plunging fire from the Chesapeake's tops. But there along the gangway, outside the ragged bulwark and the torn hammock netting, hung the old boatswain and his mates, lashing the Chesapeake fast by a stanchion, and from the Chesapeake's quarter gallery and gunroom port men were firing pistols at them, lunging with pikes, swabs, hand spikes, and one, outboard himself, was slashing down at his arm with a cutlass. Jack checked his stride, tore his pistol free, and firing left-handed, missed his man. The boatswain passed the turn, the knot was tied, the cutlass flashed down. Jack and Watt fired together, and the man dropped between the ships. But too late. The arm was gone, severed, still clinging to the Chesapeake. They heaved the old man in. Jack shouted into a seaman's ear to clap his handkerchief tight round the stump and ease him down between the main deck guns. The boatswain said something with a ferocious grin, something like, "Damn the arm!" But Jack did not catch it. He ran blundering on, awkward because of his bound arm, the quarterdeck boarders swarming past him on the gangway and below among the main deck guns. He reached the forecastle, many dead and wounded there, and saw that Broke had already boarded the Chesapeake with a score of hands. Jack followed him, jumping perilously onto the muzzle of a run-out carronade, and so over what was left of the hammocks onto the American quarterdeck. Not a living man was there, though many dead, several of them officers. But as Watt came after him, with a prodigious leap clear over the taffrail, so the lieutenant fell, shot from the mizzen-top. He was up at once, holding his foot and bawling across to the Shannon to fire a 9-pounder into the Chesapeake's tops.
"Grape!"
he shouted. "Grape!" as more boarders, seamen, and marines made their way across by every point of contact and rushed past him, gathering at the mainmast.
"Forward! Forward all!"
cried Jack. He had his sword out. It felt good in his hand, and he drove at the men packed along the starboard gangway with a dozen boarders behind him, many of them Irish, screaming as they came. Little resistance on the gangway. The officers were dead or gone, the men disorganized. Most skipped down to the main deck and thence below. A few were killed. And so to the forecastle, which Broke and his men had already cleared except for some who were plunging over the bows or trying to force their way down the fore hatchway or fighting still, cornered against the bulwark. Jack's party came pounding up. The few men fighting, now far outnumbered, threw down their cutlasses and pikes and muskets. Now most of the Shannon's marines were aboard, redcoats along the decks, and while some of them helped the seamen as they fought to keep back the desperate rushes of the main hatchway, others returned the murderous fire from the main and mizzen tops. But the ships were drifting apart, and there was no fresh stream of boarders. Broke stood for a moment. The whole issue was in the balance. If the Chesapeake's broke out from below, the Shannons on board were lost. Jack glanced at the men who had surrendered on the forecastle and who stood, glaring stupidly, bewildered, savage. Four of them he knew. Seamen, perhaps British, perhaps impressed Americans he had sailed with. And if British deserters, certain of an ignominious death.
"Craddock,"
said Broke to one of the boarders, a man with a badly wounded leg and a bloody forearm,
"guard the prisoners."
And raising his voice,
"Smith, Cosnahan, silence their tops. Main hatch. All hands to the main hatch."
The men rushed aft, Jack blundering after them, Broke coming last, and as they ran, so young Smith, commanding the Shannon's foretop, made his way out on the yard, followed by his men, and thence to the Chesapeake's main yard.
"Sir! Sir!"
roared Craddock through the continuing fire of musketry and the shouting of men. Broke turned. Some of the prisoners had caught up their weapons, and they were right on him.
"Sir!"
roared Craddock again. Jack caught the sound, whipped about, and saw Broke parry a wicked pike thrust, wound his man, and then fall, clubbed down with a musket. A third man was astride him with his cutlass high, but Jack's left-handed blow, delivered with all his strength and all his weight, flung the man's arm and cutlass into the sea, and his body into the waist of the ship. And a moment later, Broke's party laid the remaining prisoners dead. And during this quick, horribly bloody affray, the men out on the Shannon's yardarm stormed the Chesapeake's main top, while the nine-pounder's grape silenced her mizzen top. And now all the boarders were swarming round the silent main hatchway. They clapped a massive grating over it and lashed it down, and apart from one last desperate shot from below, resistance ceased. With a rending crash, the Chesapeake's quarter gallery tore clear away, and she slewed round, lying helpless under the Shannon's guns. A hoarse voice below cried out that they had surrendered.
"Are you all right, Philip?"
cried Jack, loud, although the tumult had quite died away. Broke nodded. His skull was bared, white bone through the blood, and perhaps still worse, with more blood welling from his ears. His coxswain tied a handkerchief over the shocking wound, and they sat him on a carronade slide.
"Look aft, Philip," said Jack in his ear. "Look aft. She's yours. I give you joy."
He pointed aft where the American colours were coming down. What was striking them? But now they were rising again, the white ensign undermost, as if in defiance. To those in the Chesapeake it was clear that Watt had twisted the halyards. They shouted to him, but he did not hear, and the last gun from the Shannon roared out, scattering the small party on the Chesapeake's quarterdeck, and indeed killing Watt in his triumph and several of his men. Broke stared from side to side, not fully comprehending. He fumbled for his watch, looked at it, and said,
15 minutes! Start to finish! Drive them all down into the hold!"
But now, at last, the colours rose again in their due order, soaring to the mizzen peak. Cheering, wild cheering, fore and aft, from the Shannon, and through the noise Jack cried again,
"Philip! Look aft! She's yours! She's yours! I give you joy of your victory!"
This time Broke understood. He looked hard at the white ensign against the pure blue sky, the proof of his victory. He focused his dazed eyes, a sweet smile showed on his bloody face, and he said very quietly, "Thank you, Jack." This concludes the reading of The Fortune of War by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Georges Borchardt, Inc., and was produced in 2004 by Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto.